Dear Asian Girl, for Asian girls, by Asian girls.
Hello, everybody. This is Dear Asian Girl, a podcast for Asian girls, by Asian girls. And today, I will be the host. I'm Erin, for new and returning listeners. You may know that I am a podcast researcher, but I'm an interim host for season 5. And today I am joined by Kimberly McKee, who is an associate professor of integrative religious and intercultural studies at Grand Valley State University. And she's also the author of the book Disrupting Kinship, Transnational Politics of Korean Adoption in the United States. So would you like to introduce more of yourself and tell us a little bit more about your book?
It's wonderful to meet you. I'm really glad to be here. And thanks to everybody at the Dear Asian Girl podcast for inviting me today. So I'm Kim McKee. I not only am I a critical adoption studies and Asian American studies scholar, I also am a Korean adoptee. I was adopted as an infant and I reunited with my biological parents in 2013. So it's almost been 10 years. The pandemic has really changed my perception of time, like it has for so many people. So I can't believe it's been almost 10 years. I'm currently working on a new book project, and that I should be done writing by the end of this summer. That's my deadline. And that book project looks at representations of Asian adopted women and girls in popular culture from the 1990s to the early 21st century.
All right. Thank you so much for introducing yourself. So to talk a little bit more about your book, in Disrupting Kinship, you talk about the formation of new transnational, transracial kinds of kinship as well. And I think a question that like is on like a lot of like adoptees' minds and like is in my mind as well. And like I've talked to my parents about this, obviously, because there are so many issues. And I think of maybe like issues, like an understatement, with like transracial and like transnational adoption as well. Do you think that we should be pushing towards like reforming this and just like kind of rethinking sort of like our like social attitudes about this and like having like parents like just like knowing like and being like more informed with like your book and everything about like this kind of adoption?
I mean, it's an important question. It's a question that I get a lot from people, yeah. Right? Because I think if you are an adopted person or if you read about adoption, you see it in the news, most people I think are familiar with some of the controversies, the corruption involved in international mm-hmm. adoption. People might be familiar also with abuses that are happening in domestic adoption as well as international adoption. So I guess just adoption yeah. generally. For me, I don't think adoption is ever going to go away. I think adoption is going to be part of our culture for a variety of reasons. I think what we need to be doing is working towards ethical adoption and what that actually looks like. So here I mean really promoting family preservation. And we should be asking ourselves, why is it acceptable for people to have fundraisers to help pay adoption fees, and yet we're not trying to preserve families of origin? Mm-hmm. And here I mentioned those fundraisers because I think it's about, if we're talking about economic precarity as a reason why people can't keep their kids, then why is it like socially acceptable to try to like donate to fundraisers to allow people to adopt babies, right? So I think we have to think about that. We need to think about how adoption is inherently racialized as well as classed among other isms as well, especially when considering how it's well known that within the domestic adoption marketplace, to adopt Black children costs less than adopting white children. And this is something countless of people have written about, including a dear friend, colleague, Elizabeth Raleigh, in her book, Selling Transracial Adoption. Other folks have written about this as well. It's accounting for how we really try to support adoptees of color. And so really thinking about how prepared are white parents who are sort of represent kind of the majority of a lot of adoptive parents. So how are white parents being educated about what it means to raise a child of color? Mm-hmm. For the most part, they probably aren't, even as they might have access to some resources, even as they're going to have these trainings, because even as a white person, even as a being a good ally, you're never going to sort of live in the shoes of a person of color, right? So you can read, you can attend the workshops, but I think it's also about making sure that how diverse are your social circles? How much are you willing to learn and to do the hard work? So that self-reflection, thinking about family members who may be racist and perpetuate microaggressions against your adopted child of color. What does that actually look like? Because if you aren't willing to have those difficult conversations within your family, you also need to be asking yourself, well, is my child of color going to come to me when they're experiencing racial microaggressions, racial and other forms of racist violence?
Yeah.
So I don't know if I've totally answered your question, because it was kind of a big one, right? Mm-hmm. It's a question that I think a lot of people are grappling with. But, you know, if we're going to be having these honest conversations about what it means to be adopted, I think we also have to ask ourselves why, and, you know, perhaps I might be aging myself here, but why are some of the experiences I think that I voiced when I was in high school in the late 90s, why are some of those same things being echoed in generations of adoptees today who are also sort of in kind of late high school, early college? Has anything really changed? Right. So if you think about how there was a generation of white adoptive parents who are adopting kids from, say, China, for instance, right? So folks like yourself, a lot of those adoptive parents said they were going to do it differently than, you know, adoptive parents of Korean children. And yet, right, you can watch documentaries like Found, which just came out, or documentaries like Somewhere Between, and realize a lot of the same experiences are being echoed through. There's something to be said about that, right? We should actually be taking the time to sort of think about why are those commonalities still existing if folks are having more resources. And I think something that adoptive parents of today are really fortunate about is social media. There's also more widespread connectivity online. So there's a host of more resources than there were necessarily sort of 10, 15 plus years ago.
I do agree with that as well, because like there's so much like repeated as well. And also like just like something that I want to get into as well. I do know that Korean like transnational international adoption has been, I think it's been like happening longer than like Chinese like international adoption as well. Sometimes I feel like the Korean adoptee community is a little bit more established than the Chinese adoptee community. Although we do have like organizations like FCC, and then there's like new organizations that are coming up recently as well. But I just want to like hear you, like what are like some of the largest differences in like these systems of like adoption between like Korea and China as well? I'm interested in those differences.
Okay, well, you mentioned a few different things. And so I think it's important, right? You just really referenced kind of the large scale size of the Korean adoptee community. And it's important to remember, right? Korean adoption has been going on for more than six decades. So mm-hmm. It started in that post-Korean War period. It's going on today. There are Korean adoptees who are grandparents. There are Korean adoptees who are still sort of being adopted today. Korea has maintained the largest and longest running international adoption program. Mm-hmm. And so that really will account for kind of the overrepresentation of adoptees from South Korea, both in the United States and then thinking more globally. So when thinking about Chinese adoption in comparison, right? So if you're talking about the cohort of Chinese adoptees that came kind of in that post mid-90s moment, right? We also have to remember there are generations of older Chinese adoptees that were coming from Hong Kong and other places earlier. And I think sometimes those voices aren't heard as much because they represented such a smaller number in comparison to adoptions from Korea, as well as thinking about adoptions from other Asian countries. It's just kind of because of the size and scope of the Korea program, it's really allowed for a particular kind of community to flourish. But then to go to sort of your question in terms of how I would see it, it kind of is like the replicability of international adoption programs. And so in my book, Disrupting Kinship, I talk about the transnational adoption industrial complex, the neocolonial multi-million dollar industry that commodifies children's bodies. And as an acronym, it spells T-A-I-C, and I call it TAKE. So, I mean, I think that makes people uncomfortable, right? To call anything an industrial complex, and then to talk about it in terms of commodification of children's bodies. People don't like to think about adoption as the buying of children. Mm-hmm. People don't like to think about adoptees as commodities, except for we are. There is a market. So if you think about adopted parents who are on waiting lists, sometimes you're on waiting lists for children who may not have been conceived yet, potentially, depending on the kinds of programs and when you were looking to adopt. We have to get over our apprehension in scrutinizing what adoption is. If we don't do that, we end up wondering, oh, well, does Kimberly McKee have a close relationship with her adoptive parents? I wonder what that's like. Maybe that's what fuels her research. You could say that for any other adoptee who's also an adoption studies scholar, in terms of the way in which people have like these inappropriate questions, like, oh, what's that relationship looking like? In many respects, people just assume that, oh, you must have had a single one-off negative experience for you to then making these kinds of critiques of adoption. Mm. But that's not how that actually works, right? Yeah. So, you know, when I talk about the TAKE, I look at South Korea, US, but I make the argument that sort of South Korea laid the groundwork for other adoption programs. So thinking about the way U.S. immigration, adoption agencies, and orphanages and U.S. agencies worked together to create this system, the way in which, and Catherine Joyce writes about this in her book, The Child Catchers, about how different programs would pop up and shut down in various countries in Africa. You see this in terms of thinking about sort of Guatemalan adoptions when that program was at its peak. And Erin Siegel, in her book, Finding Fernanda, has written about the fraud happening there, right? So we have to start thinking critically about what does it mean when this corruption and fraud is ongoing. And people knew about this when it came to Korean adoptions, right? So thinking about children being sent in replace of another child, which Diane Borshe Lim's documentaries, particularly in the matter of Cha Jung-hee, really touches upon that, right? And so we have to start raising these questions about what does this look like? In my book, I also talk about the way in which orphans are manufactured. And so we have this particular orphan template where it would describe Korean infants in very similar language, happy smile, round face, cute eyes, cute nose, like all of these things. And so when I was looking at the archival material, I found that these seemingly unique details that we were supposed to sort of all be these special infants, right, with these things about us, was actually really similar. Mm-hmm. And so at a certain point, I talk about this with some scholar activist friends of mine, some of whom are adoptees, one of whom is an ally, that these were the first kind of creative fiction writers about adoption, right? Because they were able to tell these tales to make adoptees palatable for people's interests.
So many things to unpack from that. But I think like one of the biggest takeaways from what you just said, how like insidious like transnational adoptee kind of like or adoption system is, and like so hard to see that sometimes, just like also because just being like, oh yeah, like I am, like you're right, like I am like adopt, like as an adoptee, like I am like sort of like this like commodity as well. But then it's like there's like this market as well. It's not only that like I'm the commodity, but it's also that like my like white parents are like the quote unquote like buyers and everything. And I don't feel like that's something that should necessarily like be like super like, oh, like we can't like talk about this or like it's taboo or whatever. But I do know that for other adoptees, sometimes just like speaking out about just like, oh, like you must have had like a very unhappy adoption. Like, no, like that's not the case. Like if you're speaking out about this stuff, for me specifically, I am like able to talk about very complicated sort of feelings without feeling like it's sort of like this huge like, betrayal or whatever. Cause I know I was talking to another adoptee and she's like, oh my God, like I never talked about like race or like anything with my mom. And she was like, I just feel like that would be too much for my mom. or whatever. So how has that process been of like being like an adoptee like scholar and then like also like having like your parents too, and like how has that like relationship sort of been?
I think it's really hard to navigate these kinds of relationships because, and I'm just going to speak generally here right now, right? Adoptees sometimes feel like they have to protect their adoptive parents. I know of adoptees who might delay searching for their birth families because they don't want to hurt their adoptive parents' feelings. Like, why is it that adoptees, regardless of age, who are still trying to protect their adoptive parents, even though their birth parents might be the same age or younger, and could also be sort of at an age where they might not be living anymore. So what does that actually mean to recover those histories? I also think too, if we keep placing adoptive parents' needs at the center, it's a problem. That's how the system has been designed because they are the ones furnishing the money to allow agencies to operate. And so by decentering adoptive parent voices, I think is one of the first things that the adoption industry really needs to do if we're going to have more nuanced and exciting conversations about adoption. So this means including the voices more of birth parents and adoptees generally in terms of what it means as I have navigated this. So when I was in high school, I submitted an essay. It got accepted into the publication of this edited collection, Yellow Girls, Reflections of... now I'm blanking on that tail end of what the book title is. So this edited collection by Vicky Nam called Yellow Girls, it just celebrated sort of its 20th anniversary last year, which is super exciting, right? But I didn't tell my parents. So I didn't tell my parents until my copies of the book show up in this box with promo material, come to my house when I was in high school. Talk about this because I think it really highlights my own discomfort when I was sort of in high school navigating these issues. I didn't feel comfortable having those conversations with my adoptive parents. I don't think that's unusual though. Yeah. I think it's very rare and really exciting when adoptees have that kind of relationship with their adoptive parents where they feel like they can actually talk to them about what it's like to be a person of color in a predominantly white family. As I've entered reunion, my adoptive mother did have difficulty with that. Right. This isn't to say all adoptive mothers will, just that my experience, that's what I found have happened. My dad did not feel that way. He was excited. I think so. I think for folks, it's just about figuring out what is the best balance for them in terms of what they feel comfortable with, both sharing with their adoptive parents, because you don't have to necessarily. I think too, if as adoptees are embarking on these journeys, I encourage all adoptees and well, just people in general to find a good therapist, right? Find an adoption competent therapist if you're an adoptee and you're struggling because you don't really know who to talk to. You know, reach out to other adoptees either on social media or within your local community. For a long time, I had played an active role in KAN, the Korean American Adoptee Adoptive Family Network. Their website is wearekaan, KAAN.org. It's a great organization. It's not just for Korean adoptees. It also has its third executive director, who is a Korean adoptee, Katie Bozek, who's also a dear friend. KAAN has been able to sort of create a space that is welcoming for various members of the adoptee community, as well as for adoptive parents and adoptive families. Adoptees and their spouses, their children, have come to the conference. And so I think it's really important to think about how adoption reverberates in the lives of adoptees as they form their own family relationships.
It's so nice to see that there are all these other like adoptee communities. And like you talking about like getting a therapist that resonated, because I think I'm sure as a lot of people, they went through like their sort of like emo phase in their like early teens or whatever. And my mom was trying to find actually like a therapist that was like either like also like Asian American or just like for like trans racial adoptees. But I don't know if like there was one or like there wasn't like something in network or whatever. So then I ended up getting a therapist who completely we ended up just talking about how she didn't like cheat. She like chopping off. It was not particularly effective. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing about that as well. And another thing, like, you brought up is, like, your sort of, like, reunion. I know for me, I just feel like a lot of my life is just, like that everything will be, like, beautiful and magical once, like, I meet, like, my birth family. In your case, did you find that that was sort of experience at all?
I would love to be able to tell you that reunion is always going to be sunshines and rainbows, but it's complicated. I think, like anything, adoption is just messy. It's complicated. For me, when I entered in reunion, I was obviously like an adult getting established in my career. I had also searched and looked for my biological parents, gosh, I want to say 3 times before that. So I had stopped and started. So one of the things people don't talk about in terms of search and reunion is the fact that there's only a small number of adoptees who are actually successful. So we tend to be overrepresented sometimes in conversations. And so if you're newer to the adoptee community, you might not realize that there's only a small percentage of adoptees who actually find success. It also is emotionally exhausting thinking about what if I don't find anything. For me, you know, I reached out to my agency twice on 2 different occasions, didn't really pursue it. I wasn't ready because it is so emotionally exhausting. You have to also make sure that you're ready to do that work because if you're not, it brings up all of these other feelings, right? And so trying to navigate what that looks like. The third time I searched, I had been living in Korea over the summer as part of the US State Department's Critical Language Scholarship Program. My Korean language teachers helped me. I was on a sort of a regional television show with another adopted person in that program. I was not successful. The point at which I'm on TV and it's still unsuccessful in Korea, I'm like, okay, maybe this is not happening. And so I had made peace with that and I was okay with that. You know, I recognize the reasons why potentially my birth family wouldn't come forward, like my birth mother. I wasn't really there to sort of try to complicate somebody's life if they didn't tell their new spouse potentially for right that they had relinquished a child, because I understand that that's not going to be easy for someone. When I did get an email from my adoption agency, which I remember their first email was like, "We have some big news, but is this the right email address?" Like, yes, it is. Could you tell me the news?
And they're like, "Your admission portal has been updated." You're like,
right? It was just kind of like, "Oh, okay." And so that's how that reunion process began for me. So that was in fall of 2013. By December of 2013, right before the Christmas holiday, when I was at that point, I was a postdoc at Grinnell College in Iowa. I flew out to Korea to meet my birth parents who are not together. And that was our first sort of trip. But, you know, I think I came to reunion in a much different place than I think a lot of other folks, because I've spent so much time studying adoption, reading adoption, engaged in kind of these intellectual conversations, that I know how I process my reunion was definitely through that perspective and that lens.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing about that. I have, not that I was necessarily like looking for like a birth parent, but I did hop on that 23andMe train and I did not find any bio relatives or anything at all. I mean, I kind of expected that too. It was just kind of like, I had been like maybe like hoping I had like this hope and then nothing came out. I was like, all right. But yeah, no, personally, I feel like right now where I'm at, I feel like I'm at like a place of like emotional stability. Because I've done the work, I feel like that's like very like vague sometimes. So just to like clarify for that, I'm like through like my viewpoint. Like when I talk about work that I've done, like on like reconciling with like my adoptee like status, that kind of just means that I have I use art in like a lot of like just like in like both like writing and art to kind of process sort of those emotions. And I'm just like very open about it, and like I just like throw all my feelings and emotions out, and like I try to like track like the sort of like feelings that I have, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like why am I feeling this way, and like this sort of like relationship, or like why am I feeling this way, like in this like breakup or whatever, like is this related to being like, or like having, I don't like the term abandoned, but all of that sort of like attachment theory. And then also I openly like seek out like conversations about like where I can like talk about like being like an adoptee. And like it's a long process. It's not something that like like happens, like just like you wake up one day and you're like, oh my god, I'm so fine that I'm like an adoptee or whatever, and like it's never going to be the perfect narrative either. And I think I had to really confront that because I wasn't able to meet my birth parents. So we were all, I think the majority of us were placed in foster care systems. So I was able to reconnect with my foster family. I think this is like 3 summers ago now, but I had like this like very beautiful sort of like picture of it just being like, oh my gosh, I'll feel so complete and finally whole. So I was like, and like that whole like in America, I don't feel like I belong or like fit in or whatever. But then I was like in China, I'll magically feel that sense of belonging. Like I didn't really do the work beforehand. So I remember just sitting in an airport and my friends had told me, they're like, Erin, this is the most queer thing ever. Cause I identify as queer. But I remember just like sitting in the airport and I was just like, and I was listening to Mitski, I was listening to Nobody, which was like, I was like, Nobody, like the entire song. And then I see this like, this family like having reunion, like the Chinese family in the Chinese airport having like this very nice family reunion. They're all like hugging each other and like it's really nice. And I just start crying, just bursting out into tears, because like I'm just like, this is not my family with my foster family like at all. And I was like, why can't it be like that or whatever, sort of like reunion in that sense. It was also I had to like do, I had to process it a lot afterwards. Like this was like a bad memory, or like maybe it wasn't like the best or whatever, but like why wasn't it the best and what can I learn from that?
Well, no, but I think you bring up something important, and I appreciate you sharing. Any kind of reunion, whether it's with your foster family, whether it's with your birth family, whether it's with extended family in your biological, you know what I'm saying, right? Yeah. Or whether it's through like say 23andMe and you connect with, you know, a third cousin, etc., right? We build these things up. We build these moments up as adoptees, right? Because yeah. they're supposed to be this alternative life, mm-hmm. right? And when it isn't that, because it's never going to be that, right? Like the dream life that you thought you might have in this reunion moment, it's not Hollywood. It's not a K-drama. It's never going to sort of be like, you're not going to have the music overlay with like the cool clothes. Like that's not how it's going. But that's what we hope. We hope that it's going to be this kind of like hyper stylized experience. When in reality, we have to really remember that reunion isn't an endpoint. It's just part of a larger story. It's the middle, yeah. right? Or part of the middle, if that's the route you choose. The other thing I think we have to remember is like, not everybody is going to search.
Yeah.
Right. And I think when we put such emphasis on search, or if you want to find your quote unquote real parents, which always kinds of makes me want to roll my eyes and squinch up my face and be like, what is actually that? That's like, it's such a construct. One of my dear friends, Shannon Gibney, is working on her speculative memoir called Botched. And she's a domestic, mixed race, Black, transracial adoptee, where she's reflecting on kind of her own experiences as an adopt and reflecting on that and thinking about, and I'm going to like botch the summary of her book called Botched. It's going to be a fantastic book. I can't wait. It's going to be a young adult, aimed sort of a young adult audience, but I think everybody should read it. Because she's really taking on a lot of these themes, these what if themes, and what does that look like in reimagining that? And if we start accepting that like adoption in general is just really weird, right? Because in what other context do we think, hey, that sounds like a great idea? Like, I wonder why the infant is crying when you hand them over to their new family. It's because that you're literally taking them from something that they knew to something that they don't know. But we can pretend that this is all normal. Okay, fine, right? If we recognize that adoption is inherently problematic, that we need a more ethical form of adoption, as well as a more ethical form about how we represent adoption in popular culture, so people have a more realistic understanding of what it actually looks like by listening to adoptees, then I think we can help kind of change that. But it also means we have to be having honest conversations about adoption, whether it's adoptees talking to one another, whether it's agencies listening to adoptees, adoptive parents listening to adoptees, making space for birth parent voices.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's when we can have sort of these more nuanced conversations.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. And yeah, no, I completely agree. And you brought this up earlier as well, just like about how social media and just like the digitalizing of like the world has kind of allowed for like more adopted connections as well. And maybe it's because like there are like these like older generations too, but also I think it's because like a lot of parents like are on Facebook, but like Facebook groups are like such a big thing for like the adoptee community. It's so much more nuanced and so much more complicated. And I just kind of like shift this conversation as well. I know that you're working on a new project now, so Disrupting Kinship. And I think this kind of relates to this representation, but specifically, I think you're focusing on media representation of like adoptee women, intersectional feminism in relation to understanding the adoptee experience. So could you discuss a little bit more about that?
Of course. So with this new project, I've been thinking about it for a long time, finally getting a chance to really think through questions about representations of Asian girl infants through Asian girl adolescence, as well as adulthood, and what that looks like for Asian American adoptees. Thinking through questions about the limits of multiculturalism and colorblindness and how that particular era really shaped and how that shaped how we understand Asian adoption, how representations in Sex and the City and Modern Family shaped understandings of infant adoption. So thinking about both Lily's, okay, Lily Tucker Pritchett, and then Lily Goldenblatt, who was eventually adopted by Charlotte York Goldenblatt and Harry Goldenblatt and Sex and the City, and then in the subsequent movies, and now in the very interesting reboot. I then look at film. I look at Sideways and Better Luck Tomorrow, that both films that came out at the turn of the 21st century, to think through what does it mean to have adoptees in both of those films where adoption actually isn't inherently central to the plot. I also look at Woody Allen, Suni Previn, and Mia Farrow, and thinking through questions about the limits of the adoptive family and the way in which Mia Farrow really cast aside Suni Previn and didn't protect her in a lot of respects. I realize as I'm like rambling and telling you sort of a breakdown of the book, I'm like, clearly I've not practiced my elevator speech about this book project. So let me just start over a little bit so I don't bore people. They're like, and it's like, so what? Why do we care about this book? But I think for me, when thinking about this book, you know, I look at a few other forms of media, including documentaries, as well as thinking about poetry and adoptee poet, thinking through questions about how does the circulation of images of Asian adopted women and girls on screen translate into the lives of adoptees? The book is looking at what I call the commodification of Asian adopted women and girls.
Yeah.
Because so often television, it's a commodity. It's interesting, as I've gotten feedback about that title, people are like, but why are we talking about commodification? Why are you looking at the political economy of adoption? I'm like, no, we commodify children in adoption. Yeah, I get that you might be uncomfortable by this, but like, no, adoptees are like, they're the commodity. And we need to talk about what that looks like and how that gets translated. You know, for the purposes of this project, I'm really focusing on adopted women and girls. Also because of thinking about the ways in which Asian adoptee women and girls find themselves hypersexualized alongside Asian American women and Asian women and girls. And yet they may not have the tools to really grapple with that hypersexualization because of the ways in which their adoptive parents never had those conversations.
Yeah, I feel that. Some people that I've encountered, it's always the guys in the East Asian department study.
I think for me, it's less about like what they say. Sometimes it is, sometimes probably because of my age, you know, when I was younger, like men would make weird comments about sort of their experiences during wartime, right? And but sometimes it's other things that are really hard for us to pin down, but we all know them because we all share those experiences, right? So it's like these unspoken truths. And so I'm really trying to also use this book as an avenue to make some of those unspoken truths visible, to think about the way pop culture traffics in a lot of these tropes. And then what happens when we don't talk about that? What happens when we see infants, Asian adopted infants and girls sort of commodified and discussed as like fortune cookies or China dolls? And that's also language adoptive parents just in real life have used when you look at some of these academic scholarship talking to adoptive parents, right? So at the point in which adoptive parents are calling their daughters China dolls, we really should also be like, so what's actually happening here?
Yeah.
Right? Because you're trafficking in sort of orientalist assumptions about Asian womanhood that you're assuming that your particular adopted daughter, who's her own person, is going to sort of fit into sort of this very submissive role in your family.
Like, I remember, like, there was like this outpouring of like all like these adoption like books, and like again, like with like the same like sort of like language, and like it's so interesting examining it. You have mentioned earlier about how you are involved in some other like adoptee communities that are like more like open and more like intersectional. So could you talk about more of the need for like an intersectional approach to adoption?
So in terms of adoption or in terms of thinking about adoptee community? Because I think those are two
different things. Adoptee communities as well, and finding like that sort of kinship.
Yeah. So before I do that, I just want to mention, because you were talking about children's books and youth literature.
Yeah.
So if folks are interested in thinking more about representations of adoption in children's literature, they should check out Sarah Park Dahlin's work. Sarah is a Korean American. She's not an adopted person. She's an ally. She's lovely. And she's doing some great work thinking about representations of adoption in children's literature and the fact that white women adoptive parents in particular, are overrepresented as authors of these children's books. And we actually just need picture books written by adoptees about it for adoptees.
Yeah.
I know that Nicole Chung and Shannon Gibney are co-editing a collection of adoptee authors writing about adoption, so there, I think it's an exciting moment in terms of thinking through what these things are looking like for folks. In terms of needing an intersectional lens for the adoptee community, I've seen just from my perspective over the last, oh goodness, since I became engaged in the adoptee community, so for roughly 15 years, I've been thinking a lot about how heteronormative some of these adoptee spaces have been. And so we really need to turn the lens in terms of sort of this heteronormativity to make it more queer inclusive for folks. Mm-hmm. I think that is happening. I think that it's mirroring a lot of other conversations people are having elsewhere. I think as an adoptee community, we also need to be addressing anti-Blackness within our own communities and holding folks accountable. Right. So as we're talking about anti-Asian racism, as for some adoptees, maybe the rise in anti-Asian racism as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic has really made them grapple with their racial identity, which that doesn't mean that as they're grappling with their identity, we can't also have that other conversation about sort of anti-Blackness. Right. Yeah. So we have to see these in conversation with each other the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that as we're having these conversations about more inclusive community, we're seeing more and more adoptee events having ASL interpretation. Yeah. So thinking too about how are we understanding what inclusivity means. The other thing too, as I think about what this community looks like, is the fact that, and I always remind folks, or try to remind folks when I meet them who might be newer to the adoptee community, is that you don't have to be friends with everybody. Like, you don't.
Yeah.
It's okay. Like, we all might be adopted, but that does not mean we're all friends. Like, we both are Asian American. Like, that's cool. I'm glad we're both Asian American. But it doesn't mean we're going to actually have the same interests. We are different people. We are unique people. And I always tell folks this because I think initially folks are excited. You don't have to explain things. It's great. You have all the feels. Cool. Not trying to deny you all the feels. But I also don't want you to feel like you have to force things when you're like, in any other context, would you be friends with this person? If that's a no, maybe you should put your energy, like making friendships with adoptees you do actually have legitimate things in common with beyond being adopted people, right?
Yeah. No, I feel that because when I came to college, like all of a sudden, in my college is like, it is still a PWI, but it's very sad that it has way more, there are more people of color at my college than there is in my hometown. But there are a lot of adoptees actually, or like relatively, there are like some people who I'm like, I don't know if like we would like buy or just like be friends under those. So I appreciate those words of advice as well. And I guess like in closing up for listeners as well, because obviously not everybody who's a listener is an adoptee. And maybe for some people, this is like not necessarily like their first time like hearing about adoption, but just like I hope that this episode has served to be a very candid discussion. But you mentioned like allyship as well, and just like you've like mentioned ally several times. So in your experience, how has allyship looked for you. What is the future of adoptee, like allyship, that you see, like you want to see it come?
Well, that is you are really bringing it with these like, loaded questions. Okay. So think about what does it mean to step up and step back in any conversation, right? So even if it is about adoption, if it's about adoption as it relates to representations of more trans adoptees or queer adoptees, as a cis hetero adopted woman, I'm not going to be able to be leading those conversations. So it's about listening, right? With intention to figure out how can I sort of amplify those voices in the room, right? It's about, and so that's just an example in terms of like the adoptee allyship, right?
Yeah.
I think it's about raising sort of people's consciousness more broadly in terms of how anti-Blackness does affect the Asian adoptee and Asian American communities, right? And so thinking about what anti-Blackness and white supremacy and settler colonialism and anti-Asian racism, how are they all interconnected? And how as both adoptees and Asian Americans, what should we be doing in those conversations, right? But in terms of Asian Americans who are like, oh, I have a friend who's adopted, or non-Asian Americans who are like, oh, you know, my family member or whatever is adopted, and like, how can I be an ally? A lot of times it's really amplifying adoptee voices, right? So if you're thinking about conversations you're hearing about adoption, it's calling people out when they're dismissive of adoptees for having, oh, that just one negative experience. I'm sure all adoptive parents aren't like that, right?
Yeah.
It's about leveraging resources. And again, it's about listening, right? So I think adoptee Twitter has been such a vibrant space. I don't really understand adoptee Instagram. Like, I don't, like, I just, it's a thing. I know that it exists. I kind of engage with it, but not really. I also learned that adoptee TikTok was a thing. I have no idea. Yeah. I'm TikTok,
but that's, I learned also that it but again, TikTok.
But I think it's about, you know, in these conversations, in these spaces, what are you doing? Yeah. Right. So, you know, I think back to when I was in college, and there was this Asian American guy that I met who told me that he felt bad that my parents were white, and I was like deeply offended, and I was like, who are you? Like, what is that? You know, and now that I'm older and I've had some distance, my initial reaction is still a little bit of that, but I also think it's about recognizing sort of those cultural losses. Asian adoptees are just as Asian American as anybody else.
Yeah.
This does not mean all adoptees from Asia identify as being Asian or Asian American. And I think, like I said before, the COVID-19 pandemic has really made that evident as you look at news stories and interviews sort of following the Atlanta shootings in 2021, where adoptees were grappling with their Asian American identities, right? Asian America is heterogeneous, and we have to remember that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I do think we need a much more expansive definition, and not only just like adoptee, like inclusion into that as well, but I know a lot of the time, like South Asians and Western Asians are not like also like including that. It's just like, so dominated and so saturated by Eastern Asians as well. I'm just like constantly challenging that sort of definition, because as you mentioned earlier, just like in talking about like the way like adoption has been typically like described, like in terms like language and like the linguistic does have power. It does. And that's something that I think that's a really powerful like sentiment, just like push forward, that we need to constantly be challenging what is this definition of Asian American. It's not something that we can like maybe like totally comfortably like settle down in. It's something that we need to just like have like more, which is a larger discussion as well. But I really appreciate that. So thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today. Would you have like just like any like last like closing words, perhaps like words of advice for other adoptees? Besides that, you don't have to be friends with like just like the other adoptees that you've encountered, which very wise words as well.
I think my biggest piece of advice for adoptees, just or for anybody for that matter, you know, if you want to learn more about adoption, if you want to learn more about the adoptee community, start doing your research. Start looking at the documentaries out there. Deanne Borsche-Lim's newest documentary, Geographies of Kinship, I know will be available on, I believe, on PBS this year. Her other documentaries, First Person Plural and The Matter of Cha Jung Hee, are fantastic, right? Mm-hmm. Look at Somewhere Between or Found, which I reference, not just as like, oh, that's all that adoption is, but as like kind of like a starting point, right? Yeah. Check out Adoptees on Twitter. Check out Adoptees on Instagram, right? And then read adoptee authored memoirs. One of my sort of most favorite memoir right now, and I just love sitting with it, is Jenny Hagen Wills's older sister, not necessarily related. And then I need to read the graphic novel memoir. Gosh, anyways, Palimpsest. And that's really exciting too. So, I mean, I think there's so many different kinds of books, memoirs, writings out there that there's something for everybody. If you're interested in adoption, it doesn't have to be just reading kind of like academic monographs.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. And of course, for the listeners, make sure to read Kimberly's book, Disrupting Kinship. And as well, look out for her upcoming work too. And thank you so much for everybody for listening today. Hello, everybody. Hello, new and returning listeners. My name is Erin. If some of you have been on the podcast before, I am a podcast researcher and interim host for season 5. And today we are joined by Grace Newton, who is the author of a popular adoptee blog called Red Thread Broken. So, Grace, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit more?
Sure. Thank you. My name is Grace Newton. I am a Chinese adoptee, and I was adopted from Nanjing, Jiangsu province when I was 3 years old. And I was raised in the Midwest, and I am a recent MSW graduate. I graduated from the Brown School at Washington University in St. Louis in the spring of 2021, and I currently work as a public adoptions social worker. So I facilitate transitions for adoptive families who are adopting from the foster care system.
Perfect. All right. So yeah, just to talk more about your blog as well. So we have like a quote from your blog over here, and it says about Red Thread Broken. So your blog aims to, quote, expose the red thread myth in relation to adoption. So could you tell us more about the red thread myth for some listeners who are unfamiliar with that?
Yeah, definitely. For those of you who don't know, there's this ancient Chinese proverb that says you are connected to everyone in your life and everyone who you are destined to yet meet through this invisible red thread. And though it can tangle and fray and get knotted up, it can never break. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is a really beautiful sentiment. However, I feel like adoptive parents and adoption agencies have co-opted this proverb for their own usage in an attempt to justify or prove that these adoptions of hundreds of thousands of Chinese, predominantly girls, were this act of destiny. And because this red thread connects you to these people. And so I believe that keeping discussions of adoption at this divine level really ignores a lot of the social, political, and economic drivers of adoption that are the causes that truly bring kids into orphanages or makes them eligible for adoption, rather than this like beautiful act of destiny. And so my blog is a critique of this appropriation of the proverb, and I try to look at social events and media representations of adoption and pieces that have an adoption focus to really show some of these other more complicated and nuanced aspects of adoption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for telling us about that. I remember like when I was younger, I would have like family friends, and they would send like my sister and I, because we're both adopted from China, they would send the picture book, and it would be like just like presenting to adoption in this like very romanticized way. which I do appreciate the sentiment, but at the same time, it kind of like erases trauma and just like the pain that like goes through where I'm at now. I think it's like really reconciling with like the transracial part, because going off to like college as well has been like just like showing me, because like obviously I'm like independent from my family, so like people only really know that like I'm an adoptee if like I tell them, and that's something that I've tried to be very open about, because I just think being open about it is really the best way for me. Transracial originated from like the transracial adoptee community. Like I think I tell people sometimes I'm transracial and they think of, oh, you transitioned, and I'm like, no. I'm Chinese and my parents are white. So how have you been like, I guess, like reconciling, or how have you like kind of reconciled with this transracial process? And do you have any stories as well about that?
Yeah, definitely want to echo your sentiment that transracial is a word that originated to describe adoptees in the adoption community. We are not Rachel Dolezals and similar people. There was a lot of erasure, I think, on both sides during that Rachel Dolezal debate around transracial adoption. I think, you know, we had some people who were fine with what Dolezal was doing and saying, sure, she can be transracial, mm-hmm. and not acknowledging, you know, that it was an existing identity for us adoptees who grew up in homes that did not match our experiences racially. I remember Roxane Gay at the time tweeted her disgust at like Rachel Dolezal, which I agree with, but her tweet was, you know, there is no such thing as transracial. And that was just erasure on the other side, that we are here, we exist. Yeah. Ethnically, when you don't have these like cultural mirrors around you, it's complicated. I did grow up going to Chinese language and dance school on Saturday mornings. My parents were very interested in China, so I always grew up feeling proud of being Chinese. But I don't think that it was until college that I really stepped into having a broader Asian American identity. That time being away from my family and away from this, you know, pseudo umbrella of white privilege was what really allowed me to step into that identity more. I went to Minneapolis and St. Paul, like the Twin Cities, for undergrad, and the Twin Cities were bigger than my hometown. And I think it was there when I was walking around, I realized, you know, oh my gosh, people are just seeing me as this Asian person. You know, maybe they think I'm like straight from China right now, but they're not seeing me as just, oh, Grace, daughter of Carol and Jim, with like all of this context and history that people have for me. And I remember in grad school, had this question of, so what does it mean then if I know that I can never be wholly or authentically Chinese in a way that would feel like fully comfortable? Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, maybe this is like a liberatory gift to myself. And I think there is something quite freeing about that, of no longer feeling like I have to achieve fluency, I have to do these things, I have to know the ins and outs of every holiday and tradition to feel Chinese. But then I also remember thinking on the other side of this question is like, well, maybe giving up this dream of achieving fluency and achieving Chineseness in a full sense, it could be internalized oppression. Yeah. So I'm still trying to figure out which side it is.
Yeah, I call like my inner critic white person, because a lot of it is just like being like, oh yeah, I need to like fit this perfect Chinese version. And I'm like, what even is the perfect Chinese version? And I think really for me, what has helped has been like having conversations with other Asian Americans, and just also I've encountered a lot of adoptees as well in college, which is so nice, and I feel like this immediate like sense of like kinship. I really resonate a lot with like you talking about imposter syndrome of like, again, like I don't speak Chinese, so like therefore, like I wasn't like raised in like Chinese culture, so therefore I am not Chinese. But I feel like also that's a common experience as well. Not to say that it isn't necessarily worsened by adoption as well, but I realized in talking to some of my other Asian American friends that like the ones like that don't know like the languages of like their homeland, they also feel that imposter syndrome. So it's definitely a very large issue that I really appreciate having like open, like candid conversations about. And a theme of our episode today is actually growing up away from your culture, which is an experience that many girls of like the Asian diaspora have faced. So you did talk about your experience as a Chinese adoptee, like, and like how in like undergrad and in graduate school, you've kind of used your studies as a way to really like reconcile or just like really explore your identity as an adoptee as well. But could you tell us a little bit more? Because I know you mentioned that like you grew up like in the Midwest.
Yeah, I grew up in the Midwest in Wisconsin. And the first elementary school I went to was actually quite international. We used to boast that there were kids from over 20 different countries. And so I really liked that aspect. I knew from the very beginning that I was from China, that I was an immigrant. And, you know, I think that having this diverse elementary school, maybe that was like one of the parts, one aspect that like sparked my interest in global international study. But after that, you know, the middle school and high school I went to in my school district was predominantly white. I do remember, you know, really sticking out. And it's funny because at the time, I remember feeling like I really enjoyed middle school and that I really enjoyed high school. But now having experienced college and grad school, oh, did I really like middle and high school that much? The odd part of transracial adoption in a lot of ways is that when we are socialized in this white way, we semi begin to identify that way. And that's the way that people also identify us. And I remember thinking about it also in terms of like this term that I don't know if it exists, but I call it racial whiplash, where, you know, you're just kind of like going along your day. And then on the one hand, people make these comments to you of like, oh my gosh, you're so white for like an Asian person, or you're like, you're basically white and you're still chugging along going on your day. And then you say something like, oh, I'm going to like try out for this school play. And then someone's like, oh, like, but this character isn't Asian. You can't do that. And just like this like whiplash of, am I Asian or am I white? Am I whatever, you know, you see me as when it's convenient for you? You know, I do have these weird times where when I think of myself, this like jarring moment where I think of myself as a white person. And then this immediate horror sets in afterwards, like, no, I'm Asian and I'm proud to be Asian. And I think that even though I am proud to be Asian.
Yeah, I really like this term, like racial whiplash as well. Because I definitely experienced that. I grew up on Long Island, and specifically my town. It was very, very, or it is still, because I still live here. It's predominantly Caucasian, and there's barely any other Asian American. And I saw recently on your blog that you have published something that's called an autoethnography. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm really excited. I was in grad school and I had a really special professor who was not an adoptee, but was a gerontologist who studied specifically the aging of older transgender folks. And when I was in her class, she would make some of these comments like, for gay people, you know, who didn't know something about the gay community, and her clients would say like, well, I was raised straight, so how would I know? And I remember thinking, I've heard that so many times from my community, except not in the sense of I was raised straight, but I was raised white. So yeah. How would I know this thing about Asian culture?
Yeah.
Or she would talk about how people wait until later in life to transition because they don't want to alarm or hurt their parents. And in the adoption community, it is common for people to wait to start a birth parent search until their adoptive parents had died because they don't want to hurt their adoptive parents. And so when she would make these comments, and I would just kind of draw these parallels between her community that she studied and then my community that I am a part of, I went to her with some of these connections I was making, and she was really intrigued by it and really encouraged me to keep diving into these issues. And so I think it was the spring of 2020, about 2 years ago now, that she emailed me that there was this opportunity that she had come across. It was a call for papers in a special issue of a journal, and the topic of the special issue is going to be adoption and trauma. But I think it was that fall, winter, that I decided I was going to try to write something for this journal. And autoethnography is kind of an interesting genre of qualitative research. And so auto as in like autobiography, and ethnography as in a cultural study. So it's this kind of inward study of oneself. Mm. And it connects the author's personal experiences with these larger political and social critiques. And so in some ways, it's kind of like what I've been doing on my blog. So it's been about a full year of writing and revising and going through the edits, but it just was published a couple weeks ago. And so if you go to my blog, redthreadbroken.wordpress.com, you can find a link to this journal article, and it is free to read and download for folks until April 15th.
Would you want to like talk more about like your research? Because like I love hearing people talk about their academic passions.
Sure. So my paper is called, The Trauma and Healing of Consciousness. And for me, I think in my social work program, a lot of the content was trauma, and my concentration in social work was violence and injury prevention. And I remember looking at existing theories of trauma for the group level, and there's, you know, historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, collective traumas. I think these are like the big ones that people think of as a community, as a collective unit. We have some of these shared traumas, but the definition of collective trauma doesn't apply because it's not from this, like originated from the single source and hasn't like shaken society outside of our community. With intergenerational trauma, we are taken away from our families. We have no way of oftentimes knowing like where in a line of intergenerational trauma we fall. And when I think about adoption history in terms of orphan trains and the stolen generation and Operation Baby Lift, different movements of child evacuations and adoptions, they're definitely historically significant events. But again, historical trauma requires this intergenerational transmission. And though I was deeply affected by learning about attempted forced genocide of Aboriginal children, which was started the Transracial Adoption Project, I'm not Aboriginal. I don't have this intergenerational aspect from that experience. And so I was trying to come up with a term that would give voice to what I consider traumatic in college, really learning about this adoption history, these painful parts of adoption history. And so the trauma of consciousness, as I see it, is just the trauma of learning of these like historical assaults of people who share an identity to oneself, and then paired with this knowledge that things are still happening and still threaten our existence and our experience. Consciousness is not purely a traumatic event, and I think that it really can give rise to healing. I know you mentioned earlier kind of connecting with the adoptee community, and I think for me that was a profoundly healing aspect of my consciousness too, because once I became aware of these really hard realities about adoption, it did propel me to seek out community.
The paper sounds so cool. I'm definitely gonna read it later. My adoptive mom is like a research law librarian / adjunct law professor, so I've been like into the academia game and just reading papers. That's like one of like my big loves of my life, so definitely I'll make sure to read this later on. Earlier I think you mentioned that currently right now you have a job where like you work with like adoptees. Like, are you like a social worker? Is that right? Yeah,
I'm
and I think there's sometimes this misconception. I know that I've talked to some younger adoptees, and even I myself, when I was younger, I was like, I don't want being an adoptee to just like define my entire life, because I was like, I just want to like live my own life and just mm-hmm. like not have everything just like be so controlled. I just want to be like a regular kid, you know. I just like go on yeah. with, like this aberration or whatever. But I feel like as I've gotten older, I just realized like, yeah, like it is like a part of my life, and like it is something that I feel like I have to just like so open about and like do work. Like that's like why like I work for this podcast, and I do like a lot of like other like Asian American oriented things, because this is something that I feel like I have to just like confront like every day, and like it is like this ongoing process, because like mm-hmm. I think some people, again, like also it's not like I woke up like magically one day and I was like I'm healed or whatever yeah. of just like being getting over, because I feel like I have done a lot of work in the past getting over or just reconciling with, because like you don't completely get over it either, because that's another mm-hmm. as well. But just being like, oh yeah, like I wasn't like my parents' second choice, and like I wasn't like just like thrown out onto the streets by my birth mother. There were like other like extenuating like circumstances, but even if that was the case, like I'm here where I am. I'm here now, and there's nothing that I can really do about that. And I have a loving family now, and I also was able to meet my foster family. So I just want to hear like your take on like your job.
I would say that I am actually quite challenged by the work I do. Mm. I think that my long-term goal is to go back to school and get a PhD.
Yeah.
And I'd like to continue interrogating some of these issues of adoption. Social work academia requires that scholars have at least 2 years of post-master's field experience. From my, you know, college experience and writing on my blog, connecting through the community, I've done extensive community work with international adoptees. And in grad school, I ended my first practicum with Missouri's, you know, basically CPS. And so and my position now is working with domestic adoptees and adoptive families adopting from the foster care system. So again, domestically. And I think that I wanted to get this kind of more rounded out knowledge of, you know, from my personal experience, I have this international side, and then looking at what are our adoptions like domestically, from the public and private system. There are definitely a lot of similar issues in terms of transracial upbringing, in terms of loss, identity, confusion, sometimes, you know, not having birth parent contact, but a lot of different issues from foster cares, because so many kids do have contact with their birth families or siblings. When I took this job as an adoption worker, I knew that I, to some adoptive parents, when I can throw the letters MSW behind my name and say that now I'm an adoption worker, that I would suddenly be seen as more credible than before, when I was just Grace Newton, regular human with a blog and an adoptee. You know, I think that some people will use my identity as an adoption worker to kind of justify and say like, oh, see, like, isn't adoption great? She's working in adoption after all. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, I know that some adoptees in the community may now, because of my role, view me as less credible than before, because, you know, I was like a rabble-rousing blogger. I still am advocating for change. I still have so many critiques of what I see happening, but I also know that I can't change everything that I am seeing in my workplace. And there are so many barriers at my organization's policy level, state policy level. It's easier to change systems and work on changing systems when you're not actually in the system. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's also been challenging navigating this kind of dual role of adoptee and adoption worker. Yeah. You know, some of my clients, very well-meaning, hoping to adopt, and sometimes say these like common phrases of, you know, not being able to have one of my own, or make some comments sometimes where I have to like really check in with myself. And is this like reaction I'm feeling a personal one as an adoptee or a professional one? How do I address this in a professional way? Is it something that's just uncomfortable and does it need to be addressed or does it not? How to leverage my identity as an adoptee in a way that is beneficial to the work that I am doing without necessarily self-disclosing to my clients that I am an adoptee. Because while I'm very, very forward about my identity as an adoptee and its saliency, it's not necessarily something I feel the need to share with my clients. Our identities and our stories as adoptees are sacred. And
I really love that. I love that. Like our adopted, like our identities are sacred, because like they are. And I think that, not that like necessarily like me like here and like you like talking about this is necessarily just like from like this one like podcast episode. But I know NPR did a podcast episode called like Our Homeland is Each Other, which is about adoption, heritage, transracial adoption. That I just wanted to like pay homage to that, and just like I feel like that idea of our homeland being each other and like adoptees and like our identities like being sacred as well, those like intertwine like with each other so much. It's just like, oh yeah, like we are like this own like special sort of like category as well. I mean, again, it comes with its own like traumas and like everything as well. But I think also I one way that I've also been trying to like view my adoption as well. I'm not saying that it isn't like a terrible, horrible thing that's like happened to me as well, but it's just like I also want to be able to like find joy in that as well, and just see that like, because like it is who I am. So it's not some I want to have like, I guess, the most like possible like just like happy and like joyous experience as well. Okay, I feel like that's really the end goal. I have done so much work in the past on this, and again, it is something that you will have to do throughout like your entire life as well. But I think it's just really powerful just to be able to like own that and be like, oh yeah, like we are sacred. We are sacred like little deities. We're not deities, but being perhaps. I just want to like hear more about like how like you like got into like your blog writing first.
Sure. Well, first, I love the sentiment that we are each other's homelands. I think that because we are removed from our homelands so young, oftentimes it can feel hard to know, like, you know, is this really my homeland? And I love that idea. I think of, like we were talking about earlier, just connecting with the community as healing. And I think that the idea that we are each other's homelands is really beautiful, because I think there have been times where I feel like, yeah, that impostery of like, am I really Chinese? Am I really this? But I think that the space that I feel most at home is with other adoptees. And there's like the least amount of explaining of my identity when I'm with other adoptees. And so I think that's really fitting that we are each other's homelands. I think for me, as far as how I got into blogging, I took a class on adoption. It was called Transnational Perspectives, Race, Politics, and the Empire of Transracial and Transnational Adoption. And this class was my first year at McAllister College. I was 18 when it started, and I oftentimes joke about how it was this like 7 to 10 p.m. night class in the cold Minnesota winter, and I was learning about such heavy things, and I would come out of that class crying with like tears literally freezing to my cheeks. And I think for me, that class really awakened a lot of feelings that, it reminded me of these experiences from my youth that I didn't really know how to put words to. And it gave me those words. It gave me the history of my people, adoptees, for the first time in history that I didn't know. And it was really jarring. It was really jarring to hear that there was so much pain from birth mothers who were coerced into relinquishing children or tricked because they thought their kids were getting a U.S. education and going to come back. There was so much pain from other adoptees that who grew up racially isolated and not knowing who they were. There are so many secrets in a lot of these adoptions, a lot of moral judgments, a lot of like other people determining what they thought were in the best interest of adoptees and children and families. And I think that when this class ended, I really needed a way to continue processing everything that I had learned. I had made good friends in this class who were also adoptees, and we would talk about things. But when I went home that summer, and I did not have a robust adoption community in my hometown, I wanted to continue doing this work that I had started. And so I decided to start a blog. I became familiar with some existing adoptee blogs through that class. Mm-hmm. And I remember my mom at first, she asked me, you know, she was like, why can't you just write this stuff in your journal? Yeah. I think that she was afraid that, you know, I was like 19.
Yeah.
I don't know about like internet stalkers and I think also just like the blowback that I would and have received from my writing. But I think that as my blog developed, my mom recognizes now that it was a very good move that I wrote this on a blog and not just in my journal. It really did evolve into something larger than just a tool for me to continue processing my academic experiences and what I had learned. I have networked with some really cool people, other bloggers online, other folks in person who've connected through my blog. I've gotten opportunities like this one, people who reached out and asked to connect on podcasts. And it is always really heartening to me when I meet people or people do tell me that, perhaps my words validated feelings for them that they had felt and when they haven't yet found an adoptee community, and that that my blog is just one way that people can find our homeland.
Yeah. Oh my God. That was such a beautiful way of tying that up at the end. And I love that story. I think that's beautiful. And I think that as well, this goes back to this like kind of, leaving like our home and like going to like college, and then as well like just like having that like our identity sort of like legitimized in college. I think that's like something like a common experience like I've had as well, and I don't know if that's like a common experience that like many other adoptees have had as well, but I do feel like because I'm a history of art major, and I've done a lot of studied a lot of Chinese art history this year, and that has just been like a very sort of affirming sort of way for me to just be like, oh yeah, like I am like legitimately like Chinese, and like I have found like other ways to just like snake my like adoptee identity through some of that coursework as well. And it's just, I think it's so wonderful that like academia can, I mean, while it is rooted and like these like Western like power hierarchies as well, it can also be a place for like us adoptees to just like to just feel like validated, and again to like find our homeland, and then like make those connections and everything, and just like take these courses where it's like, oh yeah, like our trauma, our struggles, they're real, they're legitimized, like they're actual like tangible like things. And I think that's so great. Like I love that so much, just like really coming into myself in college and just feeling like, oh yeah, I'm not the only person, like I have like this network of opportunities as well. So I know that it's approaching the close, so I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today. I really enjoyed this conversation, and for any listeners, would you, obviously we're going to like link your blog in the description as well, but would you have any other like sort of like resources? Do you have like upcoming work that like you would want to like discuss or just like throw out there for us a promotion?
I think that my blog is the biggest one. So my blog, again, it's redthreadbroken.wordpress.com. And I am also on Facebook and Instagram if you search Red Thread Broken. Yeah. And also I'm on Twitter under Grace Pinghua. So all the social media. Okay. I don't do TikTok though. That confuses me.
TikTok is its own entity. We don't go down that road. All right. Thank you so much for coming on.
Want more of Dear Asian Girl? You can find us everywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. We're on everything. Can't get enough? Subscribe, follow, rate, review to get all the updates on the latest at DAG. Let us know your feedback and what we can do to improve. We also can be found on Instagram. Follow us at Dear Asian Girl to receive updates about our latest episodes and fun facts about the host. We'd love for you to reach out. DAG, Dear Asian Girl, a podcast dedicated to share the stories of Asian girls everywhere. For the Asian girl, by the Asian girl.